Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the court. We have one case this morning, United States v. Shelby. Lieutenant Commander Fontenot, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Lieutenant Nguyen, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well, then. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Leah Fontenot, and I represent the appellant, Sergeant Kyle Shelby. Chief Judge Olson respectfully requests 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
At the heart of this case is the military judge's attempt to protect the interests of justice and appellant's right to a fair trial. And when he dismissed charge two with prejudice, he got it exactly right. Because the charge at issue on this appeal is forever tainted by an overzealous prosecutor who sought to charge an Article 120 violation when it wasn't supported by the evidence. And then he had a private conversation with the alleged victim where he influenced what she ultimately said and resulted in her changing her story to match up with his earlier misrepresentations. When given a chance to process this case again for a second time, the government then interfered with appellant's right to his established attorney-client relationship. This court should affirm the decision of the military judge dismissing charge two with prejudice for two reasons. First, the underlying prosecutorial misconduct in UCI has tainted charge two. And second, in light of the totality of the circumstances, which includes UCI, prosecutorial misconduct, and the government interference with appellant's established attorney-client relationship, dismissal with prejudice was an appropriate remedy, and it was not an abuse of discretion.
So let's explore that a little bit. Now, in Stellato, this court affirmed the military judge's determination that the case needed to be dismissed with prejudice. However, in that opinion, this court really emphasized a few critical points. The first one being that dismissal with prejudice is a drastic remedy. Number two, that it is a disfavored remedy. And number three, in Stellato, we said, military judges, you must look and see whether there is some other appropriate remedy that would cure the problem. In essence, what we were saying there in Stellato, even though we affirmed the military judge there, is, hey, military judges, to dismiss a case with prejudice is like detonating a nuclear bomb in the course of a trial. And before you push that little red button on your benchtop, you have to make sure that there is an irreparable existential threat to the fairness of the case. Where do we find that here in regard to what happened when, in regard to the UCI and prosecutorial misconduct claim, we have the military judge saying, original trial counsel, you're out. SJA, you're out. Convening authority, you're out. Dismissing with prejudice, without prejudice, claim two. And then with the second set of reasons provided by the military judge involving Captain Adcock, military judge appointed him, then gave him plenty of time to work on the case. So how is this court going to say dismissal with prejudice, that nuclear option was appropriate here?
Yes, Your Honor. And this military judge did pursue less drastic remedies the first time when the UCI was brought and litigated, where he dismissed without prejudice. But 8 months later, when this charge sheet ended up back in front of this military judge with the exact same affected charge, and at this point without appellant's entitled counsel, the military judge reconsidered the remedy in light of the total picture of the circumstances and recognized appellant cannot get a fair trial on this charge because the underlying UCI has infected the victim's account. We don't know at this point. What we do know is the victim had made two statements to law enforcement where she never said what the trial counsel said she was going to say. He signed his name to a document with the express purpose of charging a 120 so he could use it as evidence in MRE 413. Additionally, in his CAM addenda, the prosecutor states that he wanted to, quote, expand the scope of Article 120 and possibly seek legislative interest. And so when the military judge saw this charge, when he realized his remedy had not cured the taint, he was then left with facing, how he was going to, what remedy would be appropriate under the circumstances.
So the mere fact that a new convening authority continued to go forward with that charge was a sufficient basis to determine that dismissal with prejudice was the only remedy here.
There may have been other remedies. However, the military judge did not abuse his discretion seeking this remedy. When he determined that the appellant was deprived his lead counsel, he was not able to meet the Article 32 hearing with his lead counsel to advance his defense. The military judge was within the range of reasonable choices to dismiss the charge with prejudice, understanding that the military judge, he could have recognized that by cross-examining this victim, this would turn into a trial within a trial and potentially force the defense counsel to really thread a perfect needle of impeaching this witness while not revealing the potential MRE 413 evidence. This would just be unfair to this appellant, all when the charge sheet still has three different specifications which capture the gravamen of the alleged misconduct.
So let's break this down into its component parts. First off, you're talking about the fact that they're continuing to go forward, the government is, with charge two. But at this point, it's pre-trial. Why shouldn't the military judge have stood back and said, let's see what the government is going to be able to produce at trial that would show why there is this discrepancy between what was originally represented to be the statement of the victim and the actual charge that was proceeded? Why at pre-trial did the military judge say, not going forward?
Yes, Your Honor. And this is where the military judge is looking at the fact that this alleged misconduct happened in 2021. 3 years has gone by. The government has already had two bites at the apple to process this correctly, and they still have a charge sheet which captures the alleged misconduct. And so when you're looking at the interest of justice, and admittedly, even through the prosecutor's own CAM addendum, the evidence underpinning charge two, charging it that way, was exceedingly thin. And so when you're weighing the interest of justice, this was the military judge taking a pragmatic approach. And it really was narrowly tailored to the sense that only charge two is affected. So the government can go forward with the remaining charges, which still capture the alleged misconduct in an Article 134, a 120 Charlie, a 128. And so what the government loses is this particular charging theory, which really this trial counsel was using to further MRE 413 and his academic interest in whether 120 should cover this conduct. And what
it almost makes it sound as if a military judge, instead of being solely the referee, is supposed to be a player. He's supposed to decide in the pretrial context that this is a charge that should not result in a conviction. Isn't that really improper for a military judge to take on that role at that stage of the proceedings?
He didn't take on the role of deciding the outcome. He just took on the role of deciding whether this charge proceeding would be in the interest of justice. And so in the same way that in U.S. v. Stellato, this court upheld the judge's ruling, and in U.S. v. Gilmette,
I don't want to play linguistic games, but when you say military judge was deciding whether it was in the interest of justice proceeding, isn't that a different question? A question that's not appropriate for a military judge to decide what is a prosecutorial decision at that stage of the proceeding, and later it would be for the panel, as compared to the military judge deciding this trial is unfair. There's a fundamental unfairness to the accused service member here that is not capable of being cured by any alternative remedy. Therefore, my hand is forced to go with dismissal with prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would say I think that's what the military judge was doing here. Just like in U.S. v. Gilmet, when the military judge determined that something that UCI has caused an unfairness to the accused that cannot be remedied, and the only appropriate remedy is dismissal, that's what the military judge was getting to here. And again, when weighing the interest of justice and the fact that this misconduct is still captured on the charge sheet, the government can still go forward with their trial, and quite frankly, in a cleaner way where their victim is not going to be impeached by this prosecutor's original misconduct. The military judge was really making a reasonable choice under the circumstances. And this Court has said where there are violations of the right to counsel and where UCI is at play, the dismissal may be the appropriate remedy. And so here, when you're looking at the nature of the UCI, the nature of the violation of the right to counsel, and the interaction between these two things, and the fact that it's taken 3 years.
Counsel, let me ask you this. I'm a little confused, but which is normal, but I'll say this. It sounds like your position that the military judge needed to take the action he took was after the new referral by the new convening authority and after disqualification of the trial counsel and the SJ, the previous SJ. Now, at that point, you've kind of indicated you've included the IMC request. Is there any evidence of misconduct relating to the IMC determination? And what I'm getting at is that, I mean, if it's a legal call, that, you know, it's something that reasonable lawyers might agree or disagree upon. But why would the IMC request be the one thing that just decides that the judge needs to dismiss with prejudice here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do I have it wrong? Do I have the sequence wrong? I mean,
No, Your Honor. And I think I would say the IMC, the government interference with the established ACR was really the straw that broke the camel's back. The UCI alone could have resulted in dismissal with prejudice, but
Why is that, though? Just why would the IMC request in and of itself result in dismissal with prejudice?
I would take it the other way, where the UCI, which started this, could have resulted in dismissal with prejudice. Now, an interference with an established attorney-client relationship could also, prejudice can also be presumed, like it was in U.S. v. Gilmet and U.S. v. Eason. But when you take those two things together, and so in this case, the military judge was looking at the uncured UCI, and on top of that, the violation of the attorney-client relationship. And in this case, those things are important, how they interact together.
Yeah, you said the uncured UCI, but I thought that's what the judge was doing, was curing the unlawful command influence by the first dismissal.
The military judge was attempting to cure the UCI and following this court's guidance to take the least drastic remedy, and he thought by taking the actions that he took, the government would have a chance to get it right.
What's the new misconduct? I guess I'm trying to put my finger on your position. That what's the new misconduct after the first dismissal?
So in U.S. v. Gilmet, the court has said that when key components of a remedy aren't implemented, the prejudice is presumed of UCI is presumed to flow. So in this case. A key component of the reprocessing was that the appellant would continue to be represented by his lead counsel.
But counsel, where does that appear? You argue that in your briefs. But when you read the military judge's ruling in Shelby 1, I almost said Sparks 1, Shelby 1, that's not one of the elements that he imposed. He said what will cure the taint is, and he ticked off, four things that Judge Sparks just laid out. None of them is the continued representation by the IMC.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's the right that's a background right that the appellant has, is once you're detailed a counsel representing you, you have the right to maintain your counsel unless there is good cause or the proper procedures are followed. And so in the background, what the military judge presumed was that appellant would properly be represented by his counsel, his lead counsel, the counsel who discovered and litigated the UCI, a critical component to his defense. And so when he lost his lead counsel, the government continued forward, and the charge sheet looked exactly the same when it got to the military judge's desk. He was left with the recognition that his earlier remedy didn't work. It didn't bring fairness to these proceedings, and the taint continued.
Counsel, is there anything in the record from the military judge that you can point to substantiate your claim that the taint continued into the second proceeding?
I would look towards the military judge's ruling where he said that.
But he said everything you mentioned is having to do with the original claims of UCI that I think he thought maybe he had cured. And it seems like your suggestion that the taint continued, and I think you said based on what the witness was going to testify to, it just seems very speculative given that we never had the second trial.
Well, I would say the UCI at the first trial was heavily litigated. And so what we have, understand the motivation.
And I think the military judge addressed it, or he thought he addressed it, and he tried to cure it. And so the government's position, I think we're going to say, is it was cured. And your view, I think you already said, is you don't believe it was cured. But without seeing how the second trial was going to play out, it seems very speculative to decide one way or the other whether it wasn't cured.
I think this is well within the purview of a military judge who is the referee to say that the way that the trial counsel's motivations and misconduct interacted with the alleged victim, the military judge, without dismissing this charge, is not ever going to be able to put appellant back in the position he was in before the trial counsel tainted the victim, the complaining witness, of really the sole evidence underpinning charge two. And so when you look at the prior statements, where she never said what the trial counsel
said. But this is all your argument, and that's fine. But what can we look to in the record? What did the military judge find to say that, yes, the witness was tainted, and there was no way there was going to be a fair trial if this charge was allowed to proceed?
Your Honor, I would just point to the 19-page single-spaced ruling of the military judge where he adopts the findings, where he adopts the statements of law pertaining to the UCI from the earlier ruling and brought it forward into his subsequent ruling. And he essentially says, upon further consideration, after looking at the totality of the circumstances, the remedy of dismissing without prejudice is no longer appropriate. And really, he's getting to a reasonable decision to allow the government to go forward and to try their case where they've already captured it in three other specifications. All that is being lost here is a charging theory of a prosecutor who's already been determined to have been to commit prosecutorial misconduct.
I'm going to ask a question. The military judge cited the cumulative error doctrine in dismissing the charge, and the Court of Criminal Appeals said that you can't use the cumulative error doctrine before the end of trial. Now, on this appeal, you seem to be shifting grounds and saying we don't have to use cumulative error. This could have been dismissed solely because of the continuing UCI. So are you no longer relying on the cumulative error doctrine?
Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. May I continue?
Please respond.
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that the military judge, in his ruling, cited to the interest of justice, the appellant's right to a fair trial, and the cumulative error of the government. And so really, he was relying on other grounds, which pertain to the UCI, and cumulative error was kind of an add-on. And so our position is that you don't need to find cumulative error. You don't need to agree with the military judge to uphold his ruling on cumulative error, but you can, and I can argue why maybe you should, but certainly the UCI and the taint going forward and the deprivation of the right to counsel result in the judge being well within his reasonable options to dismiss with prejudice.
I think there may be additional questions.
Can I ask one more? Absolutely. So I think in Pope we said that we can't reverse on cumulative error unless we believe the appellant was denied a fair trial. Do you think that is that binding on our decision in this case?
The issue of whether the trial, the fairness of the proceeding, I think is binding. I don't think the past tense of
it. Well, let me put it this way. Do you think that you need to convince us that there was no way for appellant to have a fair trial, and that is what justified the military judge's action?
I think I need to convince you that it was that it was an abuse of discretion. So this is an appropriate remedy under these circumstances, that the military judge is remedying his right to a fair trial. So this is under abuse of discretion standard, and this was a reasonable remedy under these circumstances.
Does that prompt any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Lieutenant Commander Fontenot. Lieutenant Nguyen.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Lin Nguyen, and along with Mr. Brian Keller, I represent the United States. The court should affirm the lower court's decision for two reasons. First, the cumulative error doctrine does not apply pretrial. And even if it does apply, any prejudice was already cured by the military judge. On the first point, the lower court correctly found that there is no statute, rule, or case that permits the use of the cumulative error doctrine for trial. Second, even if the doctrine does apply, there is no material prejudice because any prejudice due to temporary severance between appellant and Captain Adcock was already cured by the military judge. The military judge granted the appellant's motion to compel Captain Adcock to continue representation after denial of the IMC request. The appellant was allowed to supplement all his pleadings, and the military judge promised appellant that he would adjust the trial dates based on appellant's preference. And for these reasons, the United States respectfully requested the court affirm.
What about the fact that he didn't have his IMC at the Article 32? Was that cured?
So, according to the RCM, denial of IMC request is a continuance for purposes of curing any prejudice from absence of that counsel. However, appellant here already had Captain Wilson as counsel, and he didn't make any objections or claim any errors regarding the Article 32 hearing, Your Honor.
Also, can you address appellant's argument that they don't really have to rely on the cumulative error doctrine? So even if we agree with your first point that there is no rule, regulation, case, precedent that establishes that you can use cumulative error before the end of the trial, that doesn't really matter in this case because the UCI by itself was enough to make this remedy, if not the only remedy, at least not an abuse of discretion.
Your Honor, theoretically, the military judge could have dismissed for UCI, for example, if he had made that determination, but that's not what happened here. He did not apply the same test, the same standard that he did when he ruled for UCI back in January. He didn't apply the test. The test is that he has to find that there was sufficient evidence brought by the appellant that there was UCI, and then afterwards is on the prosecution's burden to prove that it wouldn't affect the proceedings. He didn't do that here. All he said was there was prior UCI, and in addition, these new errors, even when the military judge said that it was on part of the defense, both its counsels and the defense service organization, the government was not absolved of that responsibility. That does not mean UCI. That does not clearly indicate any sort of test or any sort of specific grounds that would warrant dismissal. And as the court has pointed out, dismissal is a drastic remedy. And here, unless cumulative error doctrine does apply, it's arbitrary.
May I ask another question? And maybe you don't know the answer, maybe it's premature to ask this, but suppose we agree with you and we affirm the NCA and it goes back down to the trial judge and then defense counsel makes a motion to dismiss for UCI. Has that already been determined? I mean, or would that be just something that they could do if we were to send this case back?
Yes, Your Honor. So a few points. Regarding the prior instance of UCI, the military judge made the determination of proper remedy at the time. He disqualified the convening authority, the OSJA, and the trial counsel was also disqualified, and he dismissed the case without prejudice. He determined that was proper remedy for that incident that would affect that trial proceeding. We are in a new trial proceeding right now. We have a new convening authority, new prosecution. If the military judge wanted to find UCI, he has to make the determination again to see whether or not those prior incidents, in addition to these incidents, actually affect the current proceeding. But as you recognize, Your Honor, it was already cured. The military judge already cured that, gave remedy to the appellant, and the appellant did not object to the remedies. He did not appeal. As far as the United States sees it, he waived any review for those errors prior to this current court-martial.
Counsel, what is your response to the appellant's argument that the UCI still continued to taint would have tainted the second proceeding?
Yes, Your Honor, that just goes back to the test. The military judge has to apply the test. do these specific individual errors actually affect this proceeding? He didn't make that determination. That's the second prong. But he doesn't even make a determination of the first prong, whether it was UCI. Of course, the military judge did determine that the first three of the seven errors, based on his prior ruling, yes, he found UCI. But the second prong was still not conducted. He didn't determine whether or not those errors actually still affect this trial.
So I have a question about your point about that there's no case or precedent that you would, and I think anyone has pointed to, that suggests that the cumulative error doctrine applies before trial. But there are certainly other kinds of errors that would apply before trial that like UCI, that could result in such a dismissal. So is it sort of odd that we have single issues that could result in this remedy, but I think you're asking us to hold legally that you couldn't have accumulation of errors that could result in the same remedy?
Your Honor, courts have limited power, but Congress and the President has given military judges the power to dismiss for multiple kinds of errors, multiple grounds, as we can see from RCM 907, as well as precedents in the military and the federal courts. When it comes to the cumulative error doctrine, here in military practice is an expansion of Article 59. And in Pope, it was clear that it is something that's afforded really to only military appellate courts in our practice. There is no precedent.
Now, understood your position that the cumulative error doctrine only applies really in the appellate process. But I think the point that Judge Hardy is trying to get to is, even if you were to agree, if this court were to agree that the cumulative error doctrine does not apply in a pretrial context, are you saying that in other cases, a military judge could not apply the totality of the circumstances in determining that an accused service member was not being afforded a fair trial, and that there is no other remedy other than dismissal with prejudice to address that? That's distinct. Totality of circumstances being distinct from the cumulative error doctrine.
The United States position is that if the trial judges want to provide a remedy, it should be given. It should be done so by enumerated means. Totality of the circumstances.
Should be done by what?
Enumerated means of what was afforded via statute, the MCM, and precedents.
Okay, but that's a different point. I'm asking specifically, may a military judge consider the totality of the circumstances from the viewpoint of the government?
No, Your Honor.
So how do you square that with our decision in Stellato? In Stellato, where we approved the military judge's decision to dismiss with prejudice, we specifically said that it was appropriate, or at least was not an abuse of discretion, for the military judge to consider the identified errors both individually and collectively. Sounds like totality of circumstances to me. And what would be the basis for the government to say that military judge has broad and really awesome authority and responsibility to ensure that an accused service member is getting a fair trial? And yet, at the same time that we're imposing that responsibility, we would be saying, but we are going to impose blinders on you, military judge. You must slice and dice everything completely separate, discreetly from one another, and you cannot consider the totality of the circumstances. What would be the basis for this court to say that?
The United States' strongest argument is that there is a lack of precedence and authority to do so. However,
what about Stellato, collectively?
Yes, Your Honor. This Court can determine that we can apply at least something similar to the cumulative error doctrine for military judges to apply before appellate review. However, the United States argues that the Court should not do that because, and this is just speaking, just reading off a quote from the Supreme Court in Biden v. Nebraska, rules...
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what you were just saying.
Something that I... This is a quote from the Supreme Court in Biden v. Nebraska. Rules may sound technical, but they enforce fundamental limits on federal judicial power. They keep courts acting like courts. So aside from Article 59, the Court can supplement and certainly expand the doctrine, but then you'll be expanding the limits of the Court's authorities.
Now, when you say expand the doctrine, we're separating this completely from the cumulative error doctrine. We're saying cumulative error doctrine, your argument is it does not apply in the pretrial context. Okay, let's assume that's the case. The question, though, is whether the commonly used concept of totality of the circumstances that was blessed by this Court in Stellato, is it the government's position that, in fact, a military judge cannot use totality of the circumstances in deciding whether an accused service member is getting a fair trial?
So, for disclosure, Your Honor, I have not read Stellato, but our position would be to follow the rules that Congress and the President lays out that would give military judges the authority to do so. But there are cases where court precedent can provide the authority to do so. But for the purposes of this case, though, because we haven't really briefed that, we are just – our position is that the military judge abused his discretion because he specifically invoked the cumulative error doctrine. And for that reason, he abuses discretion because there's certainly no authority for that.
Counsel, you gave two reasons for why we should affirm. One was there is no cumulative error doctrine that applies before the end of a trial, and the other is, in any event, all the errors were cured. You know, it seems like we're taking a much smaller step if we go with your second ground. I'm concerned about your argument that there is no cumulative error doctrine. Imagine a case, not this case, but imagine a case where defense counsel makes a motion for appropriate relief, trial court, military judge grants relief, and then it happens again, and then it happens again, and then it happens again, and then it happens again. And after five, six such motions where the government has broken rule after rule, the military judge just says, enough is enough. This trial is not going forward. There's no way to assess multiple errors. Each one has to be handled individually. And there's no way to say enough is enough after – and I'm not saying this case is that case, but imagine a case where the government had committed errors and the military judge tried to correct them one at a time and then eventually says, you know, government, you don't have your act together. Enough is enough.
Yes, Your Honor, admittedly, it sounds frustrating. However, remedies afforded to appellants to accuse goes beyond just at the trial level. If the appellant wants to claim multiple errors and wish to get benefits from the cumulative error doctrine, he simply needs to raise it at the appellate level. But while at the trial level, the military judges have different rules, they have different authorities, and in this case here, Appen argues that the reason that the cumulative error doctrine should apply is because there is still the taint of UCI. It still has not been cured. But UCI in and of itself is a means for a judge to provide remedy. And here, the military judge did not rely on the UCI analysis or even prosecutorial misconduct to provide remedy. It was specifically cumulative error doctrine.
Getting back to Judge Maggs's hypothetical, now the military judge has at any given time an array of remedies available to her or him, do they not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if you had a situation like the one raised in Judge Maggs's hypothetical, wouldn't it depend on what remedies or remedy the judge decides to employ at that point? In other words, whether the judge says, okay, I'm going to abate the trial until you get a new counsel here, or I'm going to take a recess and we're not going to proceed again until the senior defense counsel or the senior trial counsel appears in court, or something like that, to prevent continuous kinds of issues that arise. So is some of this dependent upon what the remedy is that the trial judge uses? And it seems to be kind of like what you're saying, that in this case, he used this remedy. There was no legal basis for it. And that's the problem here? I know it's a long question, but.
Yes, Your Honor. So what it comes down to is material prejudice. So remedy does is sort of a later question after testing for material prejudice. And this is within the bounds of the cumulative error doctrine, right? Determine, military judge would find the errors and then determine in the cumulative effect, like, is there material prejudice towards the proceedings and substantial rights of the appellant? The cumulative error doctrine would allow for the military, for a military judge to basically compile all the cumulative effects in order to reach material prejudice.
Let me ask you about that, because Judge Olson raised a very interesting point, and I must say that I had not thought of it before. So. But the point being, what are the circumstances that might be considered in the totality analysis? In other words, are there instances like you have here where you have misconduct on the part of the government that's been remedied? If you later decide that, like here, the judge is not satisfied or is somehow disgruntled about how the trial is proceeding, does he then get to make another prejudice analysis that now scoops up all the other remedied activity, or now are we only focused on the new preferral, the new referral, and the new case before him? You know what I'm asking? I know you're at a little bit of a disadvantage because you haven't read the case that Chief Judge Olson mentioned, but that seems to be one of the questions that has occurred to me.
The case in ARMA somewhat touches on that when it comes to making the determination for a cumulative effect prematurely.
Well, let's assume we're not in the cumulative error world. We're in the world of Judge Olson's scenario where you have a number of circumstances, or even in Judge Maggs's hypothetical, you have a number of circumstances. What gets included in the judge's decision to award relief or award a remedy when you get to the point where, this has just gotten too much out of hand here?
I have to say, I don't know, Your Honor. And you asked this concern to provide a similar briefing to answer that question.
Oh, I'm not asking for that. I thought you might have had an idea, maybe in this case. Is your focus simply, because I heard you say earlier, your focus is on the new trial that has now started with a new convening authority, new trial counsel. So your focus is on what's before the military judge now.
I see.
Did I read that right or hear you right?
Right. So in terms of whether or not a military judge, for, let's say, just as kind of articulate the question in my own way, can a military judge consider errors from a prior proceeding or a different proceeding under the totality of circumstances in order to give remedy? So I have not found a case where a court or military judge has been able to do that. The closest thing I found, because I also was curious about that question as well.
Oh, I'm not alone, is
right.
what you're saying.
So, Walters, in the Court of Military Appeals in 1954, they said that in applying the doctrine of punitive error, the standard is demanded by Article 59, and they would have to detect the errors in the present record for any error so fundamental as to necessitate reversal of all the findings. And in the context of that, of those semantics, the United States believes that it means like it has to be the present record, it means this current trial, not the prior trial.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Lieutenant Nguyen.
Your Honor.
Lieutenant Commander Fontenot.
To respond to my colleague on the government, the military judge did not just rule on cumulative error. In his ruling on page 17, he says, under the totality of the circumstances, which it warrants this drastic remedy. And then he cites to U.S. v. Stellato throughout. And he's heeding this court's warning that dismissal with prejudice, according to Stellato, is a drastic remedy. And so when it makes sense, then when that drastic remedy is used, the totality of the circumstances, of course, should be considered, because very rarely.
But isn't some of the issue here that the circumstances he's including are circumstances that he himself has already remedied? Is that the issue, or some of the issue?
According to the military judge, the remedy was insufficient. And he adopted, so his second ruling, he incorporates by reference his first ruling, the UCI component, and he says throughout that his determination that the accused, the appellant, would be unable to get a fair trial because of the UCI, which he's incorporating into his ruling. So what he's saying is he's looking at the totality of the circumstances, and it would produce an absurd result if military judges have to artificially silo their analysis of issues when they're deciding what remedy to impose. How should they handle a situation where the interaction of these errors is greater than their parts? And that's what Stellato is. It was not one error. It was the interaction of the errors. And so it would be an artificial construct to say that if the errors are of the same kind, they can be considered in the totality, but because we have different kinds of errors, they must not be considered. That would artificially limit a military judge's ability to protect the interests of justice and due process. And so when the military judge is using the word cumulative error doctrine, but he's putting it next to the totality of the circumstances in the interest of justice and the right to a fundamental fair trial, this is exactly what we want military judges to do. They're not robots. They're capable of looking at the nature of the errors and their interaction and determine that the right remedy under the circumstances is dismissing this charge with prejudice.
Counselor, I have a question. So on page 12 of your brief, you say appellant, you're talking about this is the motion that resulted in the ruling, right? Appellant filed a motion to dismiss for speedy trial violations, asserting unreasonable delays and other prejudicial errors by the government. And I don't have my joint appendix up here, so I don't. But is there anything in that motion that talked about this theory that the new proceedings would have been tainted by the UCI from the first proceeding?
No, Your Honor. The motion focused on the speedy trial, although the UCI, of course, kind of factored into some of the delay. The military judge then ruled this way, and he did so kind of taking that big picture, backing up and looking at the whole picture and the totality.
Right. So to the extent that we want to look for evidence or something in the record that we can point to that substantiates your theory that this wasn't just a cured UCI error and then later errors and then the application of the cumulative error doctrine, that this was a continued UCI problem, we'd have to find it, because it's not in that motion. I don't think it's in any of the other motions, so it would have to be in the military judge's 19-page ruling.
Chief Judge, may I answer the question? I'm out of time.
Absolutely.
Yes, Your Honor, it is in the it's in the military judge's ruling, and again, he attached his earlier ruling, and he did attach, The earlier 39A sessions that resulted in the litigation of the UCI is also attached to the record. So it's all there, and that's what the military judge relied on.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you. Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
The court is adjourned until further order of the court.